Welcome to KZI Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, coming to you every Sunday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. and every Monday from 8 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. with interviews with authors of the latest in fiction and nonfiction. While many of us are familiar with the mob and state-sanctioned violence perpetrated against African Americans during the era of Jim Crow, what hasn't entered the national consciousness is the extra-legal violence committed against ethnic Mexicans in Texas. In her new book, The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas, Monica Munoz Martinez writes, "The decade between 1910 and 1920 was a particularly brutal period when ethnic Mexicans were criminalized and harshly policed by an intersecting regime of vigilantes, state police, local police, and army soldiers. During these years of vitriol and aggression, law enforcement officers, soldiers, and vigilantes claimed the lives of hundreds more ethnic Mexicans, citizens of the United States and Mexico alike." Born and raised in Uvalde, Texas, Monica Munoz Martinez is an assistant professor of American Studies at Brown University. From 2012 to 2014, she was a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Mexican American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. And Monica, welcome to KAZI Book Review.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Monica, so as I understand it, you first got wind of the stories of some of the violence that was perpetrated against Mexicans during the early 20th century. You were really made aware of it by a story your uncle shared with you.
That's right. So my uncle, Rogelio Munoz, I was interviewing him for my research for my thesis project when I was an undergraduate at Brown University. And I was interviewing him about his activism during the civil rights movement in Texas. And he told me the story of the lynching of Antonio Rodriguez, who was lynched in Rock Springs, Texas in November 1910. And he told me it as a way of explaining that Mexicans in Texas have always suffered from violence and from discrimination. And there's been a long effort for social justice. And so the way that he understood as a young teenager and young adult organizing to end segregation in Texas schools, to end police brutality, the way that he learned the history of the border was through not only what he studied with professors of Mexican American history at UT Austin, but also what he had learned from his community growing up in Uvalde. And so when he was a sheep shearer in Rock Springs as a teenager, he learned this history of the lynching, and then he passed it on to me.
One of the things I really loved about your book was capturing the story of the families and the victims and how they kept the story alive, how they fought for justice despite the system fighting back against them, and how even 100 years later, they never really let the stories die.
That's right. So 100 years ago, the opportunities for seeking justice were quite slim. And so what was one of the characteristics of this period of anti-Mexican violence was this broader felt injustice, that people were murdered. In many cases, there were witnesses. In many cases, police or vigilantes described their role in committing acts of violence, but very few people were ever prosecuted. And so as a result, local communities held on to the histories of these cases of violence in their family histories, but also people that witnessed violence against their neighbors. They held on to these histories and shared them with the next generation so that they wouldn't be forgotten. And so that was one way. If you look at the historical archive, the state did a lot of work to erase these histories or to erase the names of the dead. People were criminalized after they were murdered. They were described as bandits or revolutionaries. And so holding on to the name of somebody who was murdered and telling an account that gives people access to a more truthful accounting of what happened was one form of resistance and one form of resisting that kind of erasure.
You talk in the book about 1910 and 1920 as one of the, as I said in the introduction, one of the most brutal periods of repression and violence against ethnic Mexicans in Texas. What were some of the social and economic transformations that were going on? We had the Mexican Revolution going on. We had some major economic transformations. You also talk a bit about the ownership of land and more Anglo ownership of land and the creation of big farms and pushing out people on the smaller farms. So there were a lot of things going on at that time period that helped to create this ongoing violence where basically white supremacy has always existed, but it took a particular brutal toll during that time period.
That's right. So the history of U.S. expansion, of American expansion west, the colonization of the West, you know, this land, what historians describe as unique in the history of empire because it's the expansion west across land. But it was really motivated by these ideas of white supremacy through Manifest Destiny, which created the justification for wanting to move westward and conquer the landscape and displace people that already inhabited the land. And so there's this long, long-stood understanding in U.S. history that that was justified. And so the violence, the colonial genocidal violence against Native nations in the West and in the Southwest and in Texas has greatly been celebrated in U.S. history. When we look at this period of anti-Mexican violence in the early 20th century, in many ways, that period of violence is building on longer histories and deeper histories of racial violence. And so the agents of the violence themselves, the Texas Rangers, for example, were constructed, called together by Stephen F. Austin in 1823 as a group of Rangers that were needed to defend Anglo settlers. And so that understanding of violent policing and violent conflict as a defense helps to create this paradigm where natives and Mexicans are seen as the villains of history. And that was sort of cemented even by historians like Walter Prescott Webb that described this the first 100 years of the Texas Rangers, a century of frontier defense. But if you study the history of colonization and genocide and even the history of slavery in Texas, the Texas Rangers as a police force participated in violence in the name of securing newly acquired territory. And so it really requires us to rethink how we understand this period of history. But in the early 20th century, part of what was this effort for violence was this effort to displace Mexican landowning elites and to introduce a new racial hierarchy into South Texas, where there were some Mexican residents with American citizenship who were able to maintain their land despite decades of attempts and efforts to displace them. And so it was this effort where you saw the introduction of the farm colonization of the Southwest, where you saw these new Anglo populations moving into South Texas in greater numbers, acquiring property, and in some cases, when they weren't able to displace Mexican landowners, they used violence and intimidation to remove them. So there was a popular saying at the time, you don't buy land from the husband, you buy from the widow. So it really gives you this insight into the kinds of logics that were used to displace Mexican landowners and to transform the landscape by introducing new racial hierarchies, but also replacing Mexican landowners with Anglo landowners.
So there's a shared experience between African Americans and Mexicans, because a lot of the same things happened to African Americans in the Deep South and East Texas and Mississippi and Georgia, where you had a lot of African Americans actually migrate up north to escape the viciousness of Jim Crow. And there are many stories of people being forced off their land or told to sell it at a cheap price or else. So there is this intersection that you talk about in your book between the anti-Mexican and anti-Black violence through white supremacy. So there is much that we share.
Absolutely. You know, I think especially about the importance of the year 1919, which is, you know, the centennial of this year is upon us. And it's this moment where you see the organizing for civil rights by both ethnic Mexicans in Texas and African Americans in Texas. They're mobilizing and they're organizing for civil rights. And that momentum lands literally on the doorstep of the Texas administration here in Austin. And so there's people like Jose T. Canales, who is a state representative from Brownsville. He was successful in being able to launch an investigation to the Texas Rangers in January 1919. At the start of the year, the NAACP chapters in Texas, but also nationally, were looking at Texas and calling on the Texas administration to end the mob violence that was rampant in Texas. And so on the one hand, you have Canales, who's a Mexican-American politician who's calling on the state to end violent policing and extra-legal violence at the hands of the state police. And on the other side, you have African-Americans who are calling on the state to end mob violence. And the state has an opportunity to pass anti-lynching legislation at the state level, and also to reform policing practices. And what I've found in the archives is that, to the contrary, state administration, the governor, elected officials, did what they could to undermine those efforts, even going so far as to call on Texas Rangers to intimidate Jose T. Canales for bringing these charges and to intimidate NAACP chapters in Texas. And so, as a result, after 1919, you see that mob violence continues, and you also see that police brutality, not just at the hands of Texas Rangers, but also local law enforcement, continues. And you also see the rise of white supremacy. The Ku Klux Klan, increases in Texas. You know, Texans elect a card-carrying member of the Ku Klux Klan to the U.S. Senate in 1922. During the Texas State Fair in October 1923, Texans, you know, October 23rd was announced as the official Ku Klux Klan Day in Texas. And so I really think of 1919 as this opportunity for us to study what a state can do, what a governor can do, what elected officials can do to answer the calls of organized efforts in Texas for social justice, and to really come to also reckon with what it means for the state in this moment to disavow those efforts and actually embrace racial violence.
You brought up Jose Tomas Canales. He was a brave, brave person, state representative, who brought led the investigation into the violence and the murder of Mexican Americans going on at the border. And as you said earlier, he was actually being threatened. He was being intimidated. And the attorney representing the adjutant general for the state actually tried to turn the tables on him and make him into the villain during the testimony in the hearings.
That's right. So, you know, Jose T. Canales was sort of a thorn in the side of white supremacists for a number of reasons. I mean, on the one hand, he was exposing this long history of extralegal violence and exposing the brutality at the hands of the Texas Rangers, but he was also a thorn in the side because of what he represented. He was a member of an elite Tejano landowning family. They were economically well-established. They were politically and socially prominent in South Texas. And he was in an interracial marriage. His wife was white. And so in this period where you saw the introduction of Jim Crow laws in South Texas, somebody like Jose T. Canales, you know, who was educated, who was active in politics, was an elected official, he really was standing in the face of all of the efforts to try to replace men like him and to remove them from power. So he, during the investigation, had his character and his motivations questioned by the attorneys that were representing the Texas Rangers. And so Robert E. Lee Knight was one of the attorneys that interrogated Canales and during a cross-examination and questioned his motives for bringing about the investigation to the Texas Rangers. And so, you know, Canales was essentially explaining, you know, that he was a patriotic Texan, that he was a proud American citizen, and that he was trying to end the abuse of civil rights and the end of extralegal violence. And, you know, Knight, who's the attorney for the Texas Rangers, really threw that all to the side and interrogated Canales on the basis that he had Mexican ancestry. And so he questioned him about his Mexican blood, more specifically, and asked, you know, in front of you know, a room packed with congressmen, you know, his peers in the House of Representatives, journalists, you know, questioned whether or not Canales didn't have some sort of inherent bias and inherent that maybe subconsciously he was trying to remove Texas Rangers from the border so that Mexican bandits could thrive if he wasn't biased in that way. And so this really reeked of the kinds of eugenicism that was circulating, that questioned the intelligence, that questioned, you know, that portrayed Mexicans as being inherently violent. And so because he, despite being an American citizen and an elected official, because he had Mexican blood in his veins, his integrity and his motivations were being questioned. And it was, if, you know, for people who are interested in legal history, it is this quite gripping moment and a dramatic scene in the court during the period of this investigation. And so that's available in the Texas State Archives, the investigation to the Texas Rangers. And I write about that scene in particular because it exposes the kinds of interrogations that he suffered on the stand, but also outside of the committee hearings. You know, he was intimidated by Texas Rangers, and, you know, his family members were intimidated, and so it was, he did have to be very bold in taking this public stance.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Monica Munoz-Martinez. She is the author of The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas. Now, one of the sources for your book was the Los Tejanos website, which was created by Herman Contreras, who's from Houston, Texas. And as you write, he makes the vernacular histories of racial violence accessible to the public. So it's been very important that people have created and publicized or made public their own histories to give this alternative version of what was going on in Texas, especially at the turn of the 20th century.
That's right. So, you know, earlier we talked about the efforts by these investigations or, you know, in the 19-teens, there was an effort to try to erase these acts of violence, or when an act of violence became public, the media, Texas Ranger investigating officers, grand juries, you know, they essentially justified the acts of violence by criminalizing the victims. So when witnesses or family members preserved those histories, they often had to do so in the privacy of their own homes. And so a grandmother would tell the story to her grandson, or a father would share the story with his daughter. But these tended to take place in the privacy of people's homes, in these intimate conversations. And so what I was really interested in looking at, you know, websites looks like Los Tejanos by Hernán Contreras, and also the poetry and biographies that were being published and put online by local Texas residents, was that there was that more recently generations have tried to make these histories public. So move these histories and these accounts of racial violence from outside of the safety of the home, and to say we need to make these public, and there has to be a public acknowledgement of this history. And so on the one hand, that could mean rethinking the history and these myths of the Texas Rangers and the history of Texas. But it could also mean that we have to make space to mourn the loss of the people that were murdered. And so remembering the names of Antonio Longoria and Jesus Bazan, for example, we just had a Texas State Historical Marker unveiling in Hidalgo County just 2 weeks ago. And so that is the culmination of generations of efforts of trying to memorialize this history, to preserve its history. But now, thanks to the work of people like Hernán Contreras and Norma Longoria Rodriguez, we and with me and my colleagues in Refusing to Forget, we've been able to collaborate with state institutions like the Texas Historical Commission to get a state acknowledgement. And so in the absence of cultural institutions and museums and archives that have preserved these histories, preserved the names of victims and the names of the aggressors, local residents have really carried the burden of keeping these histories and preserving them. And so we are now in a moment when residents in Texas and from across the country are saying we need to have a public acknowledgement and there has to be state participation.
And you also participated in the creation of an exhibit at the Bob Bullock Museum that dealt with the violence on the border.
Absolutely. So the exhibit is called Life and Death on the Border, 1910 to 1920. Many of the artifacts that we used to pull together that exhibit, we had to borrow from Texas residents that had preserved photographs of their loved ones, of their relatives, that had objects that we could have on display. And so while the Bullock Museum could borrow from the Library of Congress or from the Autry Museum in Los Angeles or from the Texas State Archives, these institutions didn't have photographs of the dead that could give us access to telling the history of their lives, of their families, and to just give visitors a glimpse into how these histories impacted and shaped not only families for generations, but communities. And so it was a real, you know, the exhibit won awards, and it was a tremendous opportunity to collaborate with the flagship State History Museum in Texas. And you know, that museum and some of the staff working there give me a lot of hope for the work that we can do to transform, to create a more informed understanding of our Texas past.
Now, you talked earlier about an author who was a professor at UT Austin, I believe, who wrote a book, basically a hagiography of the Texas Rangers. But there was also a Mexican-American professor who was one of the founders for the Center for Mexican-American Studies, Paredes?
Yes, Américo Paredes.
Mm-hmm. Who provided an alternative view, and you, in the book you talk about how he wasn't sure his book was going to be published or they would want to heavily edit it because he was critical of the author of the myth making of the Texas Rangers, and that person also, I believe, was part of UT Press and was going to review that book.
Yeah, so Américo Paredes, when he submitted his book to UT Press for consideration for publication, he didn't know that Walter Prescott Webb, who was the historian who not only wrote the book about the Texas Rangers in 1835 that became canonical, you know, that book is quite outdated. You know, not only does it have very racist depictions of natives in Texas and Mexicans in Texas, but, you know, in terms of method, it was written in 1835. But Walter Prescott Webb also went on to shape the celebration of the Texas Centennial and helped to develop the field of public history in Texas. So monuments across the state, the celebration of the Texas Rangers and public history. He played an active role in creating a public understanding and a public celebration of the Texas Rangers. So when Américo Paredes tried to publish his book about Gregorio Cortez and his now infamous escape from mob violence in the early 20th century, Américo Paredes was quite surprised to learn that Walter Prescott Webb was going to have a say in whether or not his book could be published, and he was concerned, namely because Paredes had been so critical of Webb's history. And, you know, the book did end up being published, and you know, Webb did make recommendations for Paredes to make changes to the book, and Paredes sort of made negotiations with the press, and the book was published in 1957. And there were others before Paredes. You know, Jovita Gonzalez wrote a master's thesis that described the kinds of racial violence and the racial injustice in the early 20th century. But that first book by Paredes, you know, that came out in 1957. And despite that, 100 years after this peak of violence in 1915, we are still seeing that the work of transforming public understandings of the past is slow. And we're also seeing that there are many people in Texas who don't want to acknowledge this history, who don't want to think critically about this history. And so, you know, we have a lot of work to do to change, to develop a more critical understanding of the past that is more truthful. And so that we can also understand how the past, if we don't reflect on it and learn from it, is going to continue to shape our future. And that is really poignant in our current moment, where we see ongoing police violence, police shootings, but also the violence of immigration and border policing today.
The rhetoric of our current leader sounds very familiar based on the history you read. It's just shockingly familiar, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's you know, to see state senators and representatives 100 years ago describe Mexicans as inherently violent and as a threat to the nation, as bandits and rapists and thieves. And then to hear today, you know, that those sentiments have always been echoed and they have always shaped discrimination and exclusion and hate in Texas. But to see those, the same kinds of criminalization of Latinos and immigrants today is frightening, and we're seeing the consequences of that in the abuse of human rights, the violence against refugees, and what I've learned from the studying this historically is that not reckoning and or ending, you know, violent programs and violent policing shapes and impacts not just the targets but entire communities, and so the ramifications of this will continue to impact people across Texas and across the country and internationally. And so, you know, we have to, you know, the fight for civil rights and social justice continue today.
So how can, and we only have about a minute and a half left, but how can the African-American community and the Mexican-American community, the Latinx community, work together on the injustice never leaves you?
Mm-hmm. Well, part of it is, you know, reflecting on how these histories are so interconnected. And so the some of the victims that I found that came at the hands of Texas Rangers in the early 20th century were African American. And so that means that we have to realize that if we don't end violence targeting one racial and ethnic group, other racial and ethnic groups or marginalized groups will suffer. And so we have to learn from opportunities to find solidarity. I think that there's a tremendous amount of work that's being done by the youth generations today that see, you know, if there's a call to end the use of private prisons of American citizens, when the U.S. government then uses those private contracts or private prisons to incarcerate people who are being arrested for deportation, that is a solution, right? And so we have to think broadly and transnationally. I'm also really inspired by a conference that took place in Laredo in 1911. It was organized by the Edad family, and Jovita Edad was a participant. And so she was inspired by building cross-border coalitions. And so we have to think broadly about humanitarian solutions to immigration and border policing, but also humanitarian solutions for the incarceration crisis that we have today. And so it really requires that people study each other's history, so the history of African-American anti-Black violence and the history of anti-Mexican violence, and that provides opportunities for developing and imagining a new way forward.
So where can people online get more information on your work?
So I have a website, so you can, you know, Google my name, Monica Munoz Martinez, and find my website. You can also turn to the Refusing to Forget Project. That's where we make announcements and describe our ongoing public history projects. And I have a Mapping Violence, www.mappingviolence.com, is a project that I'm developing with students at Brown University to map the histories of racial violence in Texas against different racial and ethnic groups.
Monica Munoz Martinez, author of The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas. Thanks for being a guest on KZR Book Review.
Thank you so much for having me.